Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Direct from Beijing, China, we have Li Yan, head of the Climate and Energy Campaign in East Asia for Greenpeace. Li Yan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Well, please help us understand the climate change and energy problem from the Asian perspective. To begin, is China now the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions, and what are the latest estimates?
I'm afraid China is the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's the top one already, probably starting from 2009 or even earlier, depending on different statistics source. But however, right now, annually, carbon dioxide emission from China totally is around 9 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year. And if you calculate the per capita emission, which is so how much an average Chinese person is emitting, then it's around, I think it's beyond 7 tons of carbon dioxide. Just to give it a bit more perspective, right now, by per capita emission, China is somewhere between Italy and France. So it's already higher than Italy, but not as high as the most developed OECD countries yet.
Well, that's very helpful. I want to ask you, how much of that comes from coal?
Coal is the biggest single source of carbon dioxide from China. It's over half of the emission come directly from coal. And because if you're looking at China as a country and also a developing country, majority of its emission still is generated by energy and by its energy practice. Like people need electricity and heating and also on transport. And then coal is supplying 70%, nearly 70% of that energy, that all energy China is demanding. So actually coal is behind the strong GDP growth in the recent decade, and that's also making coal the biggest corporate in terms of carbon dioxide emission. At the same time, actually, it's also one of the biggest single source of local environmental degradation. Air pollution, water usage, land degradation, and health impacts. So if we have to talk about climate change and environmental problem in China, there's no way to get around coal.
North American news media often reports one new coal plant a week opens in China. Is that really true? And how much new coal power is coming on stream?
That's a very famous quote. I think that quote is from, again, 2009-08. Looking back now, it's actually not a week. Well, it's a famous journalist, I think, in Guardian, calculated all the coal power plants in China in that year, and then find out that by average, it's around 10 days that a new coal plant would be put online and start generating. Right now, I think the speed of new coal in China is not that high. We're at 2012, and then around 2008 and 2009, there was a high peak of coal growth. So it's not a week or 2 weeks, but it's still growing very fast.
I was just going to ask whether the new plants that are being built, it's very important whether they're efficient or inefficient, like how much coal they have to burn to produce a certain amount of power.
Yeah, exactly. It's fair that we are observing that the government, especially the central government, is trying to push through regulatory changes to require more efficient coal power plants on new builds. So there has been a large initiative in the last 5-6 years of shutting down the least efficient or the most polluting smaller plants, small boilers across the country. And then at the same time, the new build must be as efficient as possible. So looking from this technology perspective, the new power plants getting online, that's quite a difference between U.S. and China, that on the Chinese side, new plants are generally more efficient. Like right now, they're required that the ultra-supercritical power plants is required in most of the larger new projects. But there are still inefficient plants running. I think that that's one of the must-do for the Chinese government to still keeping its shutting down least efficient boilers. And back in 2008-09, it was all the plants that are below 20 megawatts must be it's the most dirty part, so it needs to be shut down. And right now, they're also moving the benchmark higher. So on that, this is the technology is upgrading. I think in general, right now, on average, to generate 1 kilowatt hour of electricity in China, the power plants on average are burning 320 or 330 grams of coal standard. And then that figure still has a bit, has a lot of space to improve, actually.
Okay. Now, is China's increased energy use a result of a growing wealthy or middle class, or is it part of the mass movement to cities that is happening pretty well all over the world, or what would you say?
The huge urbanization trend happening in China is pretty unprecedented all across the world. I remember when I was still studying in college just many years ago, we were still in news. We were described as farmer-dominated country. So 70% and 60% of the population still lives in rural area. But right now, the country is hitting a historical turning point that the population divided into urban population and rural population at about the same. And then there's also projection that over 100 million or even more people are still moving into city in the next couple of years. This is a very profound social and economic change. And yes, it is driving energy demands much faster than the last decades. At the same time, when people move to city, they want better lifestyle. They want better life. They want more comfortability with the family. So there is energy use growth driven by that as well. But I think one thing I want to point out is if we look at the data, the statistic data of energy, it's actually industry are the biggest energy user, electricity user in China, especially the heavy industry, like the steel, cement, glass, and the construction, all the construction-related industries. These industries are driven by two biggest factors. One is like we were talking about the growing demands in cities like real estate and infrastructure. But the other part is actually export-driven. It's being manufactured and it's being exported to all over the world, to other countries. So these heavy industry-driven and very energy-intensive development mode is one unique mark of China's energy footprint, I think. And to tackle the energy and carbon dioxide problem, still you have to, the government still need to work from this biggest chunk of energy requirements.
Can you describe some climate change impacts on China?
In Greenpeace, we have been traveling, witnessing what climate change really means to China in the last 6 years. This is something people, especially out of China, tend to neglect or tend to forget that actually China is one of the biggest victims of climate change. So it has a vast types of different natural disasters, and because of climate change, these natural disasters, these extreme weather events are getting worse and worse. We're seeing floods, typhoon, droughts, and heat waves hitting the population much worse in the last decades than previously. And then the worst thing is actually it's hitting the poor community the hardest. And at some places, it might even being eaten up, the economic development in the poor regions or even the poverty alleviation efforts with those communities. And a very obvious proof of climate impacts in China, as we have seen by ourselves, is the melting of the glaciers and tundras up on the Tibetan Plateau. That's being called at the Water Tower for Asia. Multiple major rivers for Eastern and Southern Asia actually originated from Tibet and has been running through, running down the Himalaya regions and all the way to feed millions of population downstream. And it's really, really, really worrying to see those glaciers melting at a very fast speed, unseen speed. This would deplete this water reserve, solid water reserve, in 3 or 4 decades' time. Right now, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but in 3 or 4 decades' time, this perspective of major rivers running out of water is really, really worrying, and it will have major impact on people, on the millions of people. That's still, I think, one challenge we're facing right now is people still tend to distance those extreme weathers and disasters happening from place that they can see and feel that this is nothing related to their lives. And most recently, I think one thing is pretty iconic in terms of changing people's mind and making them think, well, this is something happening, something is wrong with the climate. And just last month, there was a huge rainstorm hitting Beijing. It's only 8 hours, I think, 7 or 8 hours of a heavy rain. But the result is astonishing. It's actually killed 70 people in the biggest city and most populated, most advanced city in China. Putting a huge question mark of, first of all, why is that happening? Why is this big rainstorm happening? And what's the science proof behind it? And second, are we ready for those extreme disasters? And in the drought area, are we ready for more frequent flood and rainstorms? And that's actually the big question mark climate change is posing to China.
How does the state-run media discuss the climate change issue?
Again, a difference that I'm observing happening in China with other countries. In China, there is a pretty high level recognition of climate change as a science reality, and then it is a big issue. It is of a political priority that the country must tackle. There is also people questioning: is climate change true? Is the science all real? Is there any other theory? That's, again, naturally also happening. But in mass media in China, the mainstream lines about climate change is it is proved science and it is something we need to be serious about. So actually, state-run media, just from our contacts in the last years, has been actually pretty engaged in talking about climate change and its solution. I think the missing part to make it even more progressive is the source of climate change. That the media is talking about weather changes, is talking about we need carbon emission cuts, but not too many of them are directly linking the emission and weather disasters back to coal. And that we see is a pretty big problem to be solved. And there has to be a very strong link between the source and then the reason, beginning of the change, climate change consequences of it and solution of it. But generally, I think it's much better of our media reporting climate change in a much better atmosphere than that in North America.
We get weather reports, but very seldom do they mention that climate change could be part of it. And then we get a lot of car advertising or big oil companies advertising right after it. So you can see that the commercial stations depend on oil revenues and car revenues to make money. And so they're not telling us very much.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Li Yan from Greenpeace in Beijing. I know China's becoming a world leader in alternative energy as well. Can you tell us about that?
China is leading in wind energy already. This is also a kind of a legend kind of thing, because in 2005, when Greenpeace started working on wind energy in China, it's still like a high-tech, geeky new trend, and it's very, very small, just in one or two provinces having pilot projects, but just 6 years away from the beginning of the wind power development. Right now, China already has over 60 gigawatt of wind turbines installed, and it's also the biggest manufacturer in the world providing the wind equipment, wind turbine equipment. That's a result of a doubling development in several years in a row. And it's actually a very encouraging sign. At the same time, in solar power generation, like solar panels, that's something I think you can see a mixed story. That on one hand, China is the biggest manufacturer is producing all the solar panels, and majority of them transporting overseas, and especially to European market and also to North America market. And you probably also notice these huge export has been causing also trade disputes. But at the same time, being a country of vast solar potential, installation in China, really using the solar panels in China, is still pretty minimum, very, very small. 5% of the total manufactured solar panels can be used in domestic market, and it's just untapped yet. So yes, China is leading in alternative energy on many perspectives, but I think China has a way larger potential to move forward on this direction. And if you consider the urgency of the problems that we're facing, climate change and coal pollution, and also many places are being locked in the very fossil fuel driven development model, and have less choice, less options for alternative development model, then I think the country still need to speed up. I have actually strong confidence that China can be a superpower in renewable energy in the world, and there's also a lot to learn from both U.S. and Europe. Like the solar panel practice in U.S. is I think pretty encouraging. So I'll be really, really inspired if countries, these leading countries, can really treat alternative energy as a new competitiveness advantage and have a green race amongst themselves. And that would be really ideal for the world.
Li-Yan, as we finish up, could you describe some Greenpeace activities in China?
Greenpeace is established we basically started from Hong Kong in 1997, and in 2001, we opened our Beijing office. And right now, we have five major environmental campaigns, and the priority one is this one that we are talking about, the climate and energy work, really focusing on pushing forward the climate change agenda in China, in the biggest emitter and victim of the world, and tackling its heavy coal reliant energy mix. And we also have very important other campaigns on pollution, tackling water pollution and the chemical pollution in China, which is also burning issue for the public. And also the third campaign is on food and agriculture. This is with the aim to pursue a sustainable, healthy agriculture and food instead of chemical and fertilizer intensive and genetic modified pathway. And we're also working on forest protection, both protecting local forest and in southern part of China, as well as joining hands with our colleagues across the world to protect the most important hotspot in Amazon, in Indonesia, in Congo forest. And then there's a new campaign opening on ocean protection. That's the long-standing campaign of protecting like whales and other biodiversity in the oceans and against overfishing practice. So all in all, Greenpeace is already a very solid and organization, one of the leading international NGOs in China, and we have over 60 staff here. And then sometimes the most frequent question I was asked is, so are you guys still able to run campaigns in China, and how can you still run campaigns in China? I think the fact that we have 60 staff working on five really important and prosperous campaigns here is already a proof that that there's a lot of space to really pursue environmental protection in this country.
Well, yes, in the long term, a healthy environment is for the benefit of all the people and the government, so it's good the work that you're doing. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Beijing was Li-Yan, head of the Climate and Energy Campaign for Greenpeace in East Asia. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
And now more Tip of the Iceberg News. All right, let's move on to climate news. You've heard about the big news in the melting Arctic, and the runner-up is the giant drought this year in America. When the Mississippi dries up so the barges can't make it up the river, you know we're in trouble. Cattlemen sold off their beef throughout the southern U.S. as feed prices soared. You can expect cheap meat now. Stick it in the freezer, because next year is going to make you want to become a vegetarian as prices skyrocket. Do it. Become a vegetarian. It's good for you and good for the planet. America is the world's grocery store for the overpopulated poor overseas. Even though food prices are already rising, the Obama administration has not changed the policy of diverting huge amounts of corn into ethanol production. We'll burn up some family's dinner just getting to the corner store for a soda. Get ready to grow your own, or at least make friends with farmers. Fukushima. Since nobody's covering it, I have to give you a little bit of Fukushima news. Hey, Fukushima, it's so yesterday. Except this Japanese triple meltdown just keeps ticking along like a slow-motion atomic bomb. In a surreal move, various government agencies are already planning an alleged cleanup of the Fukushima region, even though radioactive cesium has a half-life of 30 years. The other elements, released in the accident up to and including both uranium and plutonium, last hundreds of thousands of years, and it's scattered all over the place. What are they going to do? Scrape up all the soil, put it in big piles, and move that all around Japan, maybe burn it up, put it into the atmosphere? It's a crazy plan. And we're already seeing artists' conceptions of green spaces and new industrial areas in the radioactive hot zones. The farmers say they're going back to growing food there next year. It's a pathetic, terrible lie for Japan. According to nuclear expert Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com, the reactor cores are likely no longer molten, just brilliant hot blobs that run away nobody knows where. The three reactor buildings are still unapproachable without risking lives. They are still building up explosive hydrogen daily and require nitrogen to be pumped in to avoid more explosions, an earthquake, or any technical problem with the pumps, the jerry-rigged system of pipes, or the electricity supply, or a human error could still lead to more radioactive explosions. TEPCO, the operator, has attempted to strengthen the Reactor 4 fuel pool building, also wrecked in the explosions. All that fuel, from 40 years of operation plus the hot fuel bundle just removed before the accident, is still balanced dangerously, precariously, several stories above the ground. Another major earthquake could drop all that fuel, likely poisoning central Japan, including Tokyo, and likely the whole northern hemisphere. They've had plenty of earthquakes since. The government is moving far too slowly to get the fuel out. Radioactive water is still leaking all over the site, including into the turbine halls. We don't know how much has reached the water table or the Pacific Ocean. The government either doesn't know, doesn't want to know, or doesn't want you to know. You must listen to a great radio podcast with anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott interviewing Arne Gunderson in the free August 20th podcast of If You Love This Planet. Download it from iTunes or find a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
I'm going to send you four before, because four was the four that stood at the door.
I have to report four trends I'm seeing in the alternative and activist scene. A rising tide of people realize climate change, energy depletion, and economic collapse are inevitable sooner or later. It is happening. Trend one. There is a chorus of famous writers, bloggers, and scientists who are publicly mourning the passing of the Holocene age and our descent into the Anthropocene, the age brought about by humankind. Many of our favorite plants and animals will not survive the change. We don't know if we will. Everything will shift underneath us like a climate quake. Author Chris Hedges, returning as I am from a summer getaway in nature, has a touching piece titled Life is Sacred. Find it at the Truth Dig blog at Rolling Stone magazine website, Truth Dig, or find a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. Hedges knows we are already on the path towards ecological destruction, at least in human terms. Like me, he fears for the times of his children. Trend 2, as I've covered in past Radio EcoShock shows with guests like Paul Kingsnorth, there is an even louder chorus calling for a quick downfall of the industrial system. One of my listeners wrote in an email, "Many believe human extinction is on its way. We need to consider a hospice society, making the way out less painful, perhaps even more joyful. There is still joy to harvest," he writes. Carolyn Baker of Speaking Truth to Power has written a great article on prepper fatigue. Lots of commentators on blogs like Zero Hedge are becoming jaded about any predictions of a financial collapse. The whole mad Ponzi scheme, which Max Kaiser calls the casino gulag, just keeps on dancing in midair. until, like Bernie Madoff, some outside force of events intervenes and the music stops?
Get ready for Survivor! Musical chairs!
Trend 3, some fairly famous figures and movement leaders are bailing out. It's not just that people are burned out hitting their heads against that immovable wall of human insanity. They're going quiet, moving to rural areas in some cases, dropping their blogs and writings, or just hanging out in cities. It's like an Atlas Shrugged situation, abandoned, but not by the industrialists. They're still in there grabbing the money, although they're becoming an extinct breed supplanted by corporate raiders. But by those people who are seeking an alternative, they are leaving, and it's not a good sign. Michael C. Rupert was the subject of the movie Collapse. Last April, he left the online community he helped found at CollapseNet.com. That's still running. You should check it out. Now he's gone to Colorado with his dog. Mike hasn't exactly gone silent. He still has his popular radio program on PRN on Sunday evenings, but he's out of here. Trend 4, related to all of the above perhaps, many people are now seeking out spiritual practices as a way to cope with the unbearable weight of knowing. Rupert is trying a mix of American Indian shamanism and Alcoholics Anonymous. Two leaders from the Transition USA movement, Michael Brownlee and Lynette Marie Hanthorne, are proposing deep transition. They are seeking ways to digest our lurch into mass suicide. Is it really a new beginning, perhaps? A hard evolution into a type of humanity that can live in nature. Find a link to that conversation on the Lifeboat Hour radio program in my blog, or Google the Lifeboat Hour and download the September 2nd program, hosted by Carolyn Baker. I'm worried a bit. In our distress, some people will turn away from science and activism toward ancient superstitions that took us centuries to overcome. Is it time to really look inward rather than outward? There's a lot to talk about here, and we will in the coming season of Radio EcoShock. In our next Radio EcoShock show, we will hear three top scientists on the record meltdown of Arctic sea ice. One guest will be Jennifer Francis, the Rutgers University atmospheric scientist, who leads observations on the way sea ice melt is changing our climate throughout the Northern Hemisphere. It's some of the most urgent science on the block with your life in the balance. We'll also hear from Dr. Cecilia Bitz, helping us understand how the Arctic climate works and why it matters so much. Plus Mark Cerise, the director of the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center, explaining the satellite shots, explaining the new record low levels of ice. It's the biggest story in many thousand years. We've not made a larger change on the Earth than this. After that, you get a surprise special on the unbelievable tipping point developing as we air condition the planet, followed by a whole program on developments in what I see as our only response so far, the Transition Town movement. Personally, I spent a month at our country village retreat. We added more insulation, 120 watts of solar power, a handy garden shed, and a large garden fence 6 feet high to keep the deer out and the other pests. My most important time was spent getting to know more of my neighbors there. Small communities are still functioning, with people helping people. I like it, and I hope to move there. It's not much, but that's about all I can do at this point, other than making radio shows for you. I'm back in the city, diving through the news, reports, and science, and truly helpful tips from listeners like you. You can write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Gear up for another nail-biting season with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As always, I thank you for listening and caring about your world.